Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is 9/03/2002. This session is, Can We Relate to Evil in a Way That Transforms It? This will be led by Michael Horn, MD. Let's listen in.
And I'm a psychoanalyst from Seattle, and I teach at the University of Washington. And you can probably hear I'm from Australia, but I'm a 25-year resident alien. And I'm about to become a citizen, actually.
You finally learned the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's right. Maybe we won't have to do it anymore. Apparently it was made up by somebody in the 19th century, and it's, I won't have to recite it, but we'll see. Yeah. Anyway, somebody just commented, if you're going to help us transform evil, that'll be nice. And I said, perhaps you're meaning good luck. Here we go. Can we start with a prayer? You need to do that for this topic. Gracious and loving God, please be with us this night as we try to understand this problem of evil. Guide our thoughts and open our hearts both to this terrible issue and to each other. Through Jesus' name, amen. People put up their hands who weren't here yesterday. Oh, quite a number. Yeah. My wife told me I should go over it anyway because it's a pretty complicated set of assumptions and series of arguments, because the arguments are coming from philosophy and theology and psychoanalysis.
Would you speak louder?
Sorry. My arguments or my points are coming from both philosophy, psychoanalysis, and theology. And that might seem strange. But actually, those disciplines were at one time, of course, one thing. It really isn't until the end of the 19th century, or the middle of the 19th century, that theology and philosophy begin to get split off, and psychology gets invented. And now we think of them as separate disciplines, and we even think of psychoanalysis as separate from psychology. But of course, underneath and underpinning all these three disciplines, there's insights that go together to bring sort of body of knowledge that I think is more richer and hopefully more enlightening for us all. There's a whole branch now of philosophical theology that's developing. It's not existential theology, but it's actually phenomenological or postmodern theology. It's very interesting because you'll hear me drawing from those sorts of sources as I try to develop this argument. There's a lot of material that I didn't do yesterday, so I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. Put up your hands and ask me questions as I go along. I'm always better when I'm dialoguing with the audience. Yesterday, when the audience finally started to disagree with me, I felt I was ready. One of the sort of important things about the so-called postmodern view of everything is that the postmodernists try to get away from the idea that you can define what is by referring back to something else. Now, in the case of evil, this would be referring evil back to some type of a force in the universe, or a force in opposition to God, or a creature in opposition to God. Like, the Bible's full of references to Satan. Jesus talks about Satan. Satan appears everywhere. So, embedded in our scripture is the idea of evil as a creature or as a force. Sometimes it's a force inside people that Jesus is getting rid of. Other times it's an actual creature that he's referring to when he's actually tempted in the wilderness by Satan. Is everyone hearing me okay? Up the back? Is that loud enough?
Yes, louder.
A bit loud. Okay. Big audience tonight. All right.
Okay.
you want the sound system on?
Yes, there is a sound system.
We can turn that on.
I can speak up if it's going to. Last night, yesterday I was trying to do the slides. It took about 45 minutes to get that working. So I think I'll just use my voice. So the postmodernist idea is that you can't refer anything back to some type of ground or originary source or some source of knowledge or some form of ultimate rationality. This sounds like a nihilism or relativism. They're the two terms that people brought up yesterday. Nihilism means that there's nothing that you can actually believe in, nothing that you can find that has any truth value. And relativism means that one person's truth competes against another person's truth, so there's no form of truth. Nihilism comes out of Nietzsche's critique of morality. And this is where we took our transition into postmodernism last night. Nietzsche said that all moral values are basically constructed, historically constructed. He wrote a book called The Genealogy of Morals, where he traced moral values back to their various origins. So Nietzsche was accused of nihilism, that there's no moral source at all. Of course, he's got a bad reputation from that point of view. But what he was trying to do was to sort of get away from the constrictive and sort of repressive nature of late Victorian morality. He's actually trying to do it as a service to to the society that he lived in, the sort of very middle class, conventional, conservative German society he lived in. But Nietzsche sort of opened the floodgates then to the postmodern world, where everything's up for critique or what we call deconstruction. And deconstruction just sort of really means what it says in a certain sense. When we deconstruct something, we break it down. So in deconstruction, we're breaking down various texts, any sort of text you like, the Bible, anything that purports to be authoritative, and looking at all the assumptions that underpin that authority. So postmodernism leaves us with absolutely no grounds for discovering truth. Everyone okay? This is where you usually get into trouble. However, what postmodernism does is actually point to a very important aspect of contemporary psychoanalysis, and this is where psychoanalysis and philosophy starts to get together. But basically, there is no certainty for human beings. That all our constructing of good and bad, right and wrong, truth, virtue, all these sorts of words are actually ways of escaping from the terrible uncertainty that human beings actually live in. This is one of the key existential ideas. It's in existential theology, of course, in Tillich. But it's also a fundamental idea of postmodernism and of contemporary psychoanalysis. Because in contemporary psychoanalysis, what we're looking at is the anxiety that we're faced with this terrible uncertainty that we live with. The existential philosopher Martin Heidegger says we're actually thrown into the world. And I like the idea that we come down a laundry chute. You know, remember those old laundry chutes where the laundry would come down to the, and you didn't know where it was coming from. You were in the basement there if it came down. We sort of arrive and then we disappear. If we're Christians, we do have the belief in an afterlife, and many religions do. But Jesus is the only person that's ever come back. So we don't really have a certainty about an afterlife either. So the postmodern and contemporary psychoanalytic view is that we actually live in uncertainty. Everyone okay so far? The other thing about the postmodern view is that in establishing a certainty, or trying to say something is, what is, we always leave something out, and there's always a what is not. So we're always setting up dichotomies of a what is versus a what is not. And this isn't a modern phenomenon. We pointed out that the very first cosmogonies, which are theories about how the universe began, were separating darkness from light, or something from nothing, or chaos from order, or order from chaos. You see, I like the chaos. You'll get that in a minute. But these are three fundamental distinctions which we hear in every cosmogony that we listen to. But last night in Psalm 139, I hope some of you heard it. Beautiful psalm that closed out our service. I'm just going to read the last piece for you. There we go. I hope people were listening in relation to this talk. This is verse 12 of Psalm 139 we were listening to.
Sorry.
Come in. Do you want another piece?
Okay.
It says, "Even the darkness is not dark to thee. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light with thee." The translation last night was prettier than this, but that's the basic point. So that the bringing together of dichotomies is a very important aspect of postmodernism. It's not really the bringing together, but deconstructing the purpose of dichotomies. As you can see, these dichotomies, light and dark, nothingness and something, and chaos and order, are all related to uncertainty. Like, order is much better than chaos. Darkness is always better than light, and something's always better than nothing. What I'm going to be trying to help you see, and this is a big part of contemporary psychoanalysis, is actually darkness is very interesting, and chaos is terribly important because it's a breakup or a breakdown, a little bit of what we talked about last night in the forum. And then nothingness is also very important, and that's the openness, the open space, which I'll be talking about tomorrow, which is vital for something new to emerge. So postmodernism, actually, far from being relativistic or nihilistic, is looking at the other, the left out, the different, in terms of people and ideas, but also in metaphysical terms, in terms of nothingness and darkness and chaos. They're three very important aspects of what you'll hear later on in the spiritual aspect of postmodernism, and especially in the psychology of Carl Jung, which I'll be talking about in a minute. So is everyone on the same page a little bit? That was a pretty brief summary of yesterday. Questions? People who were here yesterday. Sorry.
A little louder. We can't hear you.
Okay. Sorry. Any questions? People on the same page from yesterday with the people that are here today. New people. People who were here yesterday. Was that coherent? Anything else I should have said?
I understand it better today.
Good. Okay. Everyone over here. Okay. Questions? Okay. All right, well, what I'm going to try to do today is to open up some of those important issues, the darkness, the nothingness, and the chaos. Now, Carl Jung's psychology is very interesting because he's the first psychologist or psychoanalyst to bring spirituality into psychoanalysis or psychology. Psychology in the 19th century, as it developed, was even more sort of concrete or driven by method even than modern psychology is. And Freud was the first psychologist or psychological thinker to begin to break away from a very scientific view. But Freud himself was a neurologist rather than a psychiatrist. And also he was Jewish and living in Vienna where there was a lot of anti-Semitism. And he wanted to make his theory as scientific as possible to get it accepted, even though his theory is totally unscientific and actually is much more philosophical and theological than he wanted it. So he had the idea that the unconscious mind, which was his great discovery, was the source of instincts which first of all, the sexual instinct was the first one he talked about, and then the aggressive instinct. And Jung originally was a follower of Freud's. Actually, Jung was going to be the crown prince and was going to inherit the mantle of Freud. Because Jung was a Gentile, and Freud wanted to broaden out his movement to... it's difficult, really, because early on, his movement was almost totally Jewish. And he didn't want it to be a Jewish science. He wanted to broaden it out. And so Jung was brought in as the only Gentile. So he was a very privileged guy. But Jung had a different experience than Freud because he was a psychiatrist and he was working with psychotic patients. And he had just a different eye than Freud. He had a much more humanities-based education. And so he was seeing things in a very different way, in a non-scientific way. And he began to note the phenomena of the psychotic patients he was seeing in terms other than just symptoms, in terms of having some sort of meaning. So Jung, from the very beginning, was trying to find meaning in people's strange behavior and hallucinations and unusual dreams and unusual paintings and artwork and all the sorts of things people do to produce what Jung saw as the phenomena of the mind. So he had a very different view than Freud, who saw the mind as a much more mechanistic sort of driven thing, driven by energies, as it were. So Jung began to work with this particular viewpoint and developed what now is actually the lie detector test, which originally was the word association test, where patients were given a series of words and their responses were measured in terms of skin irritability and blood pressure and pulse, but also in terms of the words they produced back. And Jung found that people would produce anxiety reactions to certain stimulus words, and that around these stimulus words would develop a whole penumbra of words and a whole set of attitudes and a whole set of problems, which he called complexes. And this is the origin of the word complex. And the complexes, Jung hypothesized, were actually autonomous parts of the mind or subpersonalities. It wasn't this that we were multiple personalities, but that we had multiple selves. So Jung's unconscious became the place where the multiple selves were pushed away by the dominant self, which he called the ego complex. Ego means I. So he called it the I complex. And unlike Freud, who called it just the ego, as a thing which was there as a developed thing, Jung saw the ego complex as actually constructed by the upbringing, the culture, and the general society in which the patient lived. So Jung saw a mind as a split mind with multiple aspects of self, with one dominant self. Is everyone okay with that? Okay, so far? Good. And what Jung called the place where the other complexes were located, he called it the shadow. Of course, he did call it the unconscious too, but he used the metaphor of the shadow. So here's the darkness that Jung's already bringing into his theory. Okay? Now, Jung was very interested in theological matters of every sort. His father was a Reformed Swiss. Is that a denomination? Very, very rigid. And Jung lived in the parsonage and grew up in the fairly strict Protestant religion. And Jung felt this was a lifeless religion. It was a sort of a one-sided. It was very moralistic. Very difficult to relate to in any type of vital way. So his father is emotionally dead. And his mother, on the other hand, was rather vital, was interested in seances and spirituality and all those phenomena that were occurring at the end of the 19th century. So he had these two strange influences occurring at the same time. And his main critique of the Christian religion, and he developed this more theoretically as he went along, was that evil was not treated as a significant element or a significant reality, because the theology of the time was that evil was just the absence of good. It didn't have a reality, it didn't have a substance to it. Because as Jung began to work psychoanalytically with patients, using the model of the shadow, with the shadow personalities, he began to see these personalities emerging out of his patients. And that a very vital and important part of the cure was to bring the shadow aspects of the personality to life. Hmm. So let me just read you a quote from Jung. He says, "The shadow is a moral problem that challenges the whole ego personality." By that he means the ego complex. "For what, no one can become conscious of the shadow without considerable moral effort. To become conscious of it involves recognizing the dark aspects of the personality as present and real. This act is the essential condition for any kind of self-knowledge, and it therefore, as a rule, meets with considerable resistance. Closer examination of the dark characteristics, that is, the inferiorities constituting the shadow, reveals that they have an emotional nature, a kind of autonomy, and accordingly an obsessive, or better, possessive quality." So, I don't know whether you're up for this, because it's not an intimate audience, but I wanted to do something experiential with the shadow. Because the shadow appears particularly in dreams. And Jung's concept of dreams is that every figure in the dream is a part of the mind, based on the complex theory. So the best place to find your shadow figures are in your dreams. So, is anybody willing to begin to tell me a few shadow figures from their dreams? I'll tell you mine right off the bat. My main shadow figure was a witch throughout my analysis. And the witch actually lived as a real creature when I was a child, because we lived in a fairly old house, a bit of a spooky house actually for a kid, and it had a winding staircase, and the staircase branched off one way and went up to the left, of course, the left being the sinister side, and it went up to Mum's sewing room, and also there was a storage room up there. So when I went up to my bedroom, I always had to pass this fork in the road going up to the dark sewing room and what we call the box room. And I always thought that the witch was up there, and I'd run past this corner. And so I really thought there was a witch, a literal witch. And then when we moved to our next house, which was even older, our next house was built in 1832. It had been built by convicts. And there was a rumor that the first occupant of the house, on their wedding night, the bride had been on the balcony, like a balcony up there, looking down at the guests, and she'd leaned on the railing and had fallen down and died on the floor below in the entrance hall where we used to all walk in. And so she used to walk round the balcony at night, backwards and forwards. And my bedroom was up there like in that Mexican. And I used to hear her, of course, walking back and forth. And then this figure appeared as a witch in my dreams when I was young, but then during my analysis it appeared in all sorts of guises as a witch figure. So that was my shadow figure, and that was the shadowy part of me. My witch attitudes and a sort of dogmatism that I had, and you might hear a little bit of that now. Sort of a cuttingness that I could do at times, and hurtfulness with words, etc. So does anybody have a similar dream figure? We've just snuck them down, we've got a witch. Any others?
It probably wasn't shadows, but it would be dreams of violent death,
uh-huh.
Violent dying of siblings and Violet dying of myself.
What was the mode of death?
Dreams I've had was an axe gets split in the head of my brothers, uh-huh. and an axe gets split in the head of me, and my eyes pop out.
Is there anyone holding the axe, though?
At first, I kept the original dream was a person that always was like the bully in our high school,
uh-huh.
but then it had no face later on.
The axe was just an axe.
An axe.
Okay, so sometimes in dreams we can just have something like an axe or a car. I have a patient right now that has tidal waves as his shadow. Destructive tidal waves. Some patients will have nuclear bombs will go off. I once had a dream where a nuclear power station blew up just near me. So that was a shadow element in my dream, too. So anything else? Surely.
I used to have a recurrent dream of going up to this old house, and I just knew there were ghosts inside. And uh-huh. it was very scary. And I would walk around the outside of it, and for some reason I wanted to go in, but I was too scared. And uh-huh. finally, as an adult, one day I had the dream, and I walked in, and there were ghosts. And
right.
they were scary. And I looked at them and they looked at me and then they left.
Uh-huh. So, right.
But that scared me a lot. Sometimes I didn't want to go to sleep in case I had that when I was young.
Ghost left when she walked in the house. Or she walked in the house and then the ghost left.
Yeah. And they really were.
Do we have any dream experts who'll make up Jung's theory off the bat and close the lecture there and then? What did she do? She went into an old house. What would the old house might be? It's okay if we interpret your dream?
Sure, go for it.
So the old house is probably a symbol of some old part of herself. Houses are usually symbols of ego states. And when we're ready to confront our shadow figures, we will actually enter the old houses. For example, was my witch. I've tried to enter the house where the witch was time and time again. I was always going up to the box room or the attic or whatever. I could never get to the witch, try as I might. And then finally, I went into a town with a square, and the witch came out of a house. And the witch actually came towards me. And as she was coming towards me, she suddenly transformed herself into a white cockatoo. Anyone's been to Australia, it's a beautiful bird. And that was the end of the witch. And this was the time when I was beginning to be able to incorporate some of the witch aspects into my ego. We'll talk about this in a little while when we talk about overcoming evil. But this is a typical sort of dream when the person is beginning to be able to make a relationship with the shadow figure. Okay? Is that okay? I've got blank looks, so... No? No? Yes? This is what's happening in our unconscious as we begin to make relationships with these unconscious figures, particularly the shadow figures. We're always... All the figures that are separated from the ego are figures of the shadow.
I had a similar one to that with a lion that was trying to get in the house.
Here we go.
Yeah. And yeah. I was very afraid of it.
Right.
And I was trying to close the doors in the rest of the house so that it could not get to those safe places.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't succeeding too well.
Right.
And I did eventually allow the lion into where I was.
Okay.
And it was quite... It just wanted to be there. Just
there we go. Here's another example of the ego trying to keep the shadow figure, the lion in this case, away from itself. This is what the ego complex is always trying to do. But when the ego complex is through life experience, through spiritual experience, through psychoanalysis or whatever, is beginning to be able to make a relationship with the shadow, you'll see this being worked out in the dreams. Okay? Now, what do we notice about these elements? We've got a witch, an axe, tidal wave, a nuclear power station, a ghost, and a lion. What's a common quality that we could...
Dangerous.
Dangerous, right?
Scary.
Scary.
Death.
Bad?
Death.
Death? Death? Now, what's dying what might die? What important thing might die in the mind as the shadow figures do their work? From yesterday. Did we talk about the ego complex? The ego will begin to... No, we didn't. We didn't get up to that. So we're interested actually in the ego complex eventually dying. In other words, the concept of ourselves... Oh, we talked about that in the forum a little bit, didn't we? The breakdown and breakthrough thing. So we're really actually interested in the ego breaking down. And the shadow figure becoming incorporated with the ego is part and parcel of the breakdown of the ego. So we've got scary and dangerous and what other... adjectives would we put on the shadow figures?
Powerful.
Powerful, there we go. Any other word?
And bad, we're afraid that the bad will take over the good.
Oh, of course, yeah.
There's no defense, there's no defending.
That's right. So power is an important part of it, right? Take over, they'll take over. Nothing else?
Does the shadow come from the personal unconscious or the collective unconscious or?
Well, I told my wife I'd answer all the questions that people ask me. Gary's brought up a huge question. Part of Jung's problem was he was a postmodernist theorist, and the shadow's a very postmodern theory. It's purely a theory of splitting of the shadow figures off from the ego complex. But he's also a modernist theorist, and he developed this theory of the collective unconscious, and that all the complexes have as their base what are called archetypal forms. And these are inherited forms that are in every human being. So the witch is an archetypal form. We see the witch in all different cultures. We see her in fairy tales and mythology and all sorts of things like that. So Jung sees the witch in his archetypal theory as an archetype. In the shadow theory, which is a much more postmodernist theory and doesn't rely on anything that underlies it, he just sees the witch as part of the personal unconscious. Okay? Is everyone okay with that for now? We're not going to do archetypal theory because we can't really develop this idea through archetypal theory. Because the whole idea is that we don't have anything underlying these figures. But one other thing about the shadow figures is that they have vitality. Would everybody agree with that? That lions and tigers, creatures like that, snakes, they're another common shadow figure, all have tremendous vitality and energy. Energy is another word that we see. But of course they're, in conventional, usual sense, they're bad because they're destructive things. They're often very destructive. Patients often have things like alligators, which eat children. Or another patient of mine has a man with another huge axe, which goes around beheading people. So they're very violent and bad, and we would call them...
Evil.
Thank you. Evil. So we don't have to really look at our human behavior. We can do this by looking at our behavior. You know, we all do evil things from time to time. We're critical, or we leave people out, or we've probably done those things in the last few days. But our shadow figures are actually what we would normally call evil in normal life. You know, if snakes and nuclear power stations were blowing up, or nuclear bombs, or ghosts. You know, this is an evil, what we conventionally think of as evil.
So is that why it's always your evil twin?
Right.
That's something bad?
Exactly. That's the basis of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Robert Louis Stevenson was the first author, well, not the first, but one of the most famous authors to really develop this idea. Although he developed it purely from a literary basis, but probably from his own psyche. Does everyone know the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Yes.
Yes, good. Okay. Okay, so that's Jung's theory of the shadow, and this is how we see it when we're doing psychoanalysis. And in psychoanalysis, the figures that interest us most are the figures that are most alien from the ego complex. The axe murderers and the ghosts and witches and all the horrible things. So let's go back again to a little bit to the postmodernist philosophy that we talked about last time. And I don't think we talked specifically about Michel Foucault, but he did a wonderful study where he looked at the history of the exclusion of the mentally ill throughout European history from about the Renaissance. And what he discovered was that the mentally ill were always an excluded class, but they were excluded for different reasons in different ages. So in the Renaissance, they were excluded because they were foolish or irrational. And they were actually literally excluded. They were put onto ships called ships of fools, and you might have seen paintings of this. They were basically sent out to sea and just sailed the seas. And then in the late Enlightenment, when things were heating up and the Industrial Revolution was beginning, the mentally ill were excluded with the poor and the criminal classes, because they were the unproductive classes. So they were actually in the same prison or confinement spaces as these other groups. And then in the 18th century, the 19th century rather, they were released from these prisons, the mentally ill were, and this was seen as the humane treatment of the mentally ill. But then the mentally ill were shunted off to asylums in the countryside, and they were deemed to be immoral, and they got moral education. Actually, Christian people would go in there and teach them the Ten Commandments or whatever. I don't know what they were doing with the psychotic mentally ill people in the asylums. And then in the 20th century, we decided that the mentally ill basically are biologically defective. So most mentally ill, seriously mentally ill patients these days don't have any psychotherapy at all. They're treated purely with chemicals. And yet, even the most serious schizophrenic patients have been shown to respond to a certain degree to psychotherapy. So Foucault maintains that we wanted to exclude this class because it's so alien. The mentally ill are almost the most alien class that we have in any society. And we've wanted to exclude them when we've made up different reasons to exclude them at different periods. They're just a constant shadow element, and yet there's no rational reason for their exclusion because it changes all the time. It changes from culture to culture, depending on the dominant culture. So what I'm suggesting in my definition of evil is that evil results when we decide what is correct, what is right, what is rational, what is good. And then we exclude in one way or another, and we exclude first of all by shaming, and then by shunning, and then by confinement like the mentally ill, or placing outside of society into an asylum or a ghetto or something of that nature. And then we move on to more serious forms of exclusion, when we begin to obliterate people, when we begin to do things like ethnic cleansing. And of course, in the most horrible endpoint we do, we fight wars, and we basically try to kill off the whole nation that we're fighting against. And we're in the middle of one of those right now. What happens with the excluded groups? The excluded groups, like the mentally ill, can be totally powerless because you don't see people marching on Washington in support of schizophrenics, or schizophrenics marching on Washington. They're a very, very powerless group. Or the slaves, the African-American slaves in the last century. So basically those groups can remain oppressed or even obliterated, like the Australian Tasmanian Aborigines were basically obliterated by the British settlers. They moved right across Tasmania and forced the Aborigines into smaller and smaller areas, and the ones that tried to break through the lines were shot, and then the ones that they captured, they moved to a tiny island, and they almost totally died out. There's basically no Tasmanian Aborigines left. However, in other situations, like the Northern Ireland situation, which I showed you yesterday, the obliterated group, or the pushed out group, which were the Catholic minority, can fight back. And then you have a clash, a terrible clash, where evil is being perpetrated on both sides. One side's trying to obliterate the other. And what was your name?
Barbara.
Barbara was telling me about her trip to
Israel.
To Israel. Do you want to say what you said to me?
When I went to Israel and the occupied territories on a trip through Augsburg College, I saw the kind of things that he showed in his slides yesterday. The graffiti, the bombed out areas, just devastation.
Right. It's the most horrible situation, I think, when you get the two protagonists sort of facing each other in such close quarters. I think Israel is, and Northern Ireland are two of the most horrendous that we have. And of course, Rwanda was another horrible example of that. Now, that's where we are. We've got postmodernist philosophy about the exclusion of the other. And we've got Jung's concept of the internal shadow, which is exclusion of the other. Is everyone okay so far? Now we're going to give you some hope, or I hope I'll be able to give you some hope. And I think some of the hope begins with the theology of Karl Barth. Karl Barth was a Swiss, actually. He lived in Germany. And he was basically a contemporary of Jung's. And Karl Barth's the developer of what was called neo-orthodoxy. And the basis of his theology is the return to a covenantal relationship with God as the totally other. He was very much against the 19th century theology, dominant theology, which was a concept of an internal God, a sort of a personal God. Barth wanted to return to the God that was out there, that was other, and that we were in dialogue with. That God was revealing itself in the dialogue with the humans. So it was a backwards and forwards process, and a very active process. It's a very interesting theology. And I don't think Barth influenced Martin Buber, who was a Jewish theologian, but I think it was a zeitgeist. The concept of the other was beginning to emerge, really out of Nietzsche, and some existential or phenomenological ideas were beginning at this time. So the concept of the absolute other in relation to humans was beginning to develop. And Buber takes this idea one step further in his concept of the I-thou relationship. The I-thou means that if one comes to somebody as a thou, they allow that person to presence themselves or to emerge fully as the individual that they are. And Buber saw this as a spiritual or a numinous, which is it's hard to define. Spiritual is a word I just don't like any longer. Numinous is a sort of an emergence or a awesome experience or experience of being overtaken by something beyond oneself. And if one responds to somebody as a thou, which we occasionally do, you know, once every year or so we'll be able to pull this off. It's a very open and difficult way to relate to someone. This I-thou experience occurs. And Buber contrasts this to the I-it relationship, which is the way we were relating to each other most of the time. And now, Immanuel Levinas is the person I really want to talk the most about, and I think is the most help in this huge problem that we have?
I didn't catch that, Emmanuel.
Levinas, Emmanuel Levinas. He's actually L-E-V-I-N-A-S. I was looking in the bookstore and I couldn't find any of Levinas's books. They might be in the library. He's died in about 1985. He was Polish, and he moved to Germany to study, and he studied with Martin Heidegger, who's the founder of existentialism. So Levinas had an existentialist education, or a phenomenological education, but he was also a devout Jew, and he was steeped in Jewish theology. So there's a mixture of, again, theology and philosophy informs Levinas's theology. And then he moved to Paris. He became part of the whole postmodern movement in Paris. Now, Levinas's idea is that when we're relating in the I-thou situation, we're relating to the face of the other. It's actually the face that is the most vulnerable, the most individual, and the most revealing, and the most difficult to encompass. We know how we turn our eyes away when we're looking at someone, when we don't want to be as intimate as we might be if we made eye contact. And it's not just eye contact, it's taking in the face. Because for Levinas, the face is very vulnerable, and it speaks backwards into the whole of the person, both in this numinous and spiritual way, but also in the massive individuality and difference of the other person. That's the most important thing about Levinas' idea, is that we're always other to each other, and we can never fully encompass the other, and we can never totally incorporate the other, and we're always confronted by the other in new and different ways. I brought up some of that last night in the talk when I was talking about working in Pioneer Square, where there's just about every other that you can imagine in Pioneer Square. There's the middle class, there's the upper class, because we have art galleries in Pioneer Square, and there's several homeless shelters, and there's these wonderful benches all around Pioneer Square. I like to sleep. So it's the absolute mixture of everything, and taking it in is just a very difficult task. Some mornings I walk to work and I'm just like this. And I don't want to look and take in what's in, on the square. So Buber's concept is that taking in the face is not an easy thing, it's a constantly difficult thing, and it's something that can never be overcome. You can never fully take in another person. And the other aspect of his theory is that ethics for Levinas is always in a giving way, because if I don't take in the face of the other person, I am occupying a place where that other person could be. So in not taking in, I'm always pushing away or taking up a place that the other person could occupy. So it's a very difficult ethical standpoint. And here, if we get back to Jung, the whole point of psychoanalysis of the ego complex in relation to the shadow is the ego complex has to give away to the shadow. And it's only in the giving away to the shadow that the shadow's energy can be incorporated into the whole personality, and as we see about the ghosts disappeared, and my witch turned into a bird when I was ready to incorporate the witch's energy. Well, I did a slip there, the witch enemy, because the witch was the enemy. I was seeing the witch as the enemy, and incorporating the witch in some way which I still don't fully understand, the witch's energy is transformed into the bird, or in Nancy's case, the ghosts disappear, or the lion lost its scariness, right? Did the lion lay down with the lamb? Did it go that far?
It was just there, comfortable, and
there we go, right.
Just
So the what I'm proposing in this model, and what Levinas is trying to talk about, Levinas is very against what we call human rights. Because he says as soon as you start to settle on human rights, even though they look good, there's still something that's going to be left out. That relating to the face of the other, or relating to the complete otherness of the other, is something that you can't codify. It's very much an individual daily struggle. And so what Levinas would advise in the times that we're living now is that we must take in the face. So that would mean taking in what's just occurred, the face of the terrorist. Whatever the terrorist has got to say to us, Levinas would be asking us to take in. In psychoanalysis, internally, we're asking the patient to begin to take in all these terrible figures. So externally, the other, the so-called evil other, and internally, our own evil other. Both in psychoanalysis and in social and political discourse, we're asking ourselves to totally take in the other, and we're not finding any prescriptions because you just don't know what's going to happen. You know, the lion might lay down, or something else might happen with the lion, or whatever. We just don't know. There's nothing we can predict. So again, it's this terrible uncertainty, and it's the reliance on this concept that Jung has, and that I think is essential really to our Christian concepts, and we find it, you know, when we look at the psalm, we don't find the splitting of the dark and the light. There's all sorts of places in the Bible where these opposites come together. So what one of Jung's big ideas was wholeness or totality or more completeness, really, was what he was looking at. So there's something that's massively out there that we can't formulate and that we're always being asked to take in. So this gets us back to the beginning, what I was talking about was the nothingness. So we're opening up a space and the chaos, we're asking for breakdown. And the darkness, it's the things that we can't see and that we're frightened of and that scare us in our dreams. And I've actually got a quote from the Bible, and I'm not a biblical scholar, so Barbara helped me out. it's in several places. It's in Matthew and it's in Luke, but the best quote here is, here we go. Remember then what you received and heard. This is from Revelations. Keep that and repent. If you will not awake, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what hour I will come upon you. So I think what's being said here is the thief, the evil one, if you will not awake, if the ego complex will not awake to the presence of the internal shadow, that shadow will come anyway. And I will come upon you. So I think it's in four places. I knew it was in at least one place, but it's in four places in the Bible. Jesus refers to it, the thief coming in the night. And there's a wonderful gypsy proverb, which I'll just kind of end on. Same idea. Where is it? It's a gypsy saying that one should only rob the victim who is ready. Okay. So thank you. Questions, comments, horrified disagreements.
Okay. How does the casting out of evil spirits that occurs in the Bible, or you know, sending the demons packing?
Right.
How does that fit into this?
Well. I've had several patients who've had demons sent packing in various what do we call them? I want to be polite.
Exorcisms.
Exorcisms, yeah, sort of exorcisms. And the demons are these creatures, you know, these horrible creatures. The patient, once the patient's beginning to feel the shadow figures in daily activities or daily life, it just feels very tormenting and demonic. Because like a dream, it feels completely separated from the waking ego. And various types of procedures can do this. And what's happening then is forms of what we call projection. They're being projected out somewhere else. And they actually, in the exorcism ceremonies, that some exorcism ceremonies, people actually hide little bits of something up their sleeve, or, you know, noises occur or whatever, to sort of help the patient feel that that's actually got out. But of course, it just gets out into somewhere else. You know, it's put into other people or into black people or whatever. And I, of course, Jesus' exorcism seemed to work. People seemed to transform. I think Jesus was doing a form of integrating of the shadow figures with the ego complex. He wasn't doing it. Jesus was too sophisticated to do exorcism.
Jesus was Jungian?
Yeah, absolutely. The Bible's incredibly paradoxical and difficult. And he's always referring to Satan's, and he is casting out demons. But the people seems to be a transformation that occurs. When people go through exorcisms, it's like what we call a flight into health. It's too good to be true. And there's no vitality pickup. When people integrate the shadow figures, the ego in daily life begins to pick up all sorts of vitality. I have a patient right now who's tremendously passive before she was able to integrate actually a snake figure. It was her shadow figure. And now she's able to ask for a special chair at work so her back doesn't hurt. She's playing music through the computer during the day to entertain herself. She's got a new little tape recorder which she puts all sorts of information into that she doesn't forget. All little snaky little sorts of things. Sneaky things that she's got to make her day better. Just told me all this on Friday. And there's been a whole series of dreams. The snake was very alienated from her originally. And then the snake's been gradually doing a similar thing to Bob's lion. Has been making approaches towards her house, trying to get in the window of the house. And now finally has actually got into the house and into the ego. And you can see the results in the different sorts of behaviors that she's having. This is so interesting. They were all little sneaky, tiny things that sort of breaking the rules, but not really breaking the rules, because nobody really worried about it. And it's making her work environment so much better. So if there's been a true integration, you see it in the behavior, the ego behavior of the person. And this whole process is very painful, because when you first come across these figures, when they first arise in the dreams, or in other intimations inside oneself, when someone's getting in touch with sort of an evil feeling in themselves, it's quite frightening and difficult, and takes a long period before this process goes to completion. And of course it's the same thing externally. Coming to grips with the other externally, look, coming to grips with African Americans in our culture is a massive problem. It's been going on for 100 years and we're still struggling with it. So taking in the other is just not an easy thing at all. Go ahead.
I have a question based on something I heard you say today, and I think I heard you say yesterday that evil tends to exclude. Mm-hmm. It sets up a dichotomy.
Right.
How then do you respond to the biblical idea of holiness?
Well,
is that a fair question?
It's a fair question.
Okay.
But I have a worry about holiness. Unless we talk about it as wholeness, I'd be okay with that. The holiness always is usually dichotomized with unholiness, isn't it?
Right.
So it's a problematic word. So I'd rather look at it as wholeness. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather look at that more as completeness than wholeness. Because wholeness implies something a little bit too formulaic. I'm actually not very pleased with wholeness or completeness. I'm much more with Levinas, that you're never going to be able to fully take in the opposite or the other. So I think of holiness as what I call radical tolerance and patience. Because you have to be terribly tolerant, and it's very hard to do. And you have to be massively patient. I was really pleased the way you were talking about waiting today. How difficult it is to wait for things to evolve. And so an ethic, I think, that you draw out of Levinas's ideas is the idea of tolerance that's never ending, really. You can never get over being tolerant, and you always have to be patient, because there's always something that's going to show up to trip you up. And holiness just is too finite and final for me, I'm afraid.
That's helpful.
Okay.
I have so many questions running through my mind that I'm back. I'm a little confused. Okay, but I promise.
Got 2 minutes.
That's the last one.
Okay.
So if we could, mm-hmm. and if we could look at the other space and incorporate that space, mm-hmm. and see, maybe another way of putting it would be to see myself in that space too. What we have. Well, actually,
it's not. It's actually seeing your not-self.
Or my not-self in that space, but in a way that tolerates,
right.
In a radical tolerance. I like that mm-hmm. concept. But what are we to do with our world right now, Mike, when we're told what evil is? I mean, our media has said to us, the other is evil. Mm-hmm. And then, how do we get to the place where we can take in that shadow, that in us, you know? How do we get to, because if you automatically label it right from the get-go in the media, then what would be the average citizen walking down the streets payoff for taking a look at the other? If someone like our president has already done the labeling.
Well,
yeah.
We've got
4 seconds.
I'm still a resident alien. I could be probably deported if just a quick one, you could probably answer this yourself. Why do you think our politicians have labeled this axis of evil, and they've even, instead of calling it terrorists or terrorism, they started with terrorists, it went to terrorism, and it's now terror. So it's actually become a thing. Terror has become a thing, and evil is a thing, right? In their labeling. So what have they actually done? Going back to yesterday, they've tried to make us all feel what?
Right.
No, well, certain.
And
certain.
Powerless.
No, actually powerful. Because if we can find evil, we can go to Afghanistan and go into a cave somewhere, and there it is, you know, like the Ark in Raiders of the Lost Ark or something like that. We can actually, when you reify something or make it real or make it concrete, like evil or terror or whatever, that's reduces the fear, because we can actually locate terror people, I guess, if that's what... Well, see, terror is divorced from people, it's a thing. But it's become a thing. So it's going to this certainty thing that I talked about yesterday. So the first step would be to deconstruct evil and terror and terrorism. And these are people who did these dreadful things. We would start with that. That's much more frightening, because there are other people out there apparently planning these dreadful things. They unearthed another cell apparently recently, somewhere in the Midwest, I think, of all places. You know, so to actually do what Levinas wants us to do in our present situation would be terrifying, because we would actually have to take in what's actually occurred, that there are people out there that want to do terrible things to basically innocent people in the United States. This is pretty horrifying if we took this in. So if we're having a war against the evil axis or terror, there's something we're actually fighting. We don't have, we actually go out and do something.
But we
so
can.
That's all I'm saying.
But we can then, somehow it gives us permission to become terrorists.
Right, to attack back. But it still could give us permission because we could label the people as evil people, and we have done that.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
We could label them as evil people. And the most difficult and almost impossible thing for us to do at this point, it's difficult for any of us to do, but if we did try to take in the act somehow and try to just meditate on it, I guess it's about all we could do at this point. I've tried. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do. I can't really do it yet. But what we've done in the last 12 months, I think, is just put off that process of taking that in, and how dreadful that all is. And then the other side of it is the deconstructive side to our ego complex, to our identity as Americans. Because I think of myself as an American now, about to become a citizen. I think I told you that at the beginning. Our ego is being attacked by a dreadful shadow figure, because this is a dreadful blow to our identity. You know, nothing like this has ever happened on American soil. And I think that's why we see all these flags around. It's a type of a stabilizer of our identity, that we're still intact because we have the flag that's sort of keeping us together. So on both sides, both the taking in the terrible shadow action and the dreadful attack on our national identity. You know, it's just a massive, massive thing to do, which we just haven't been able to do at this point. Oh, of course, we do it in bits and pieces. People are doing it, trying to do it. So on both sides, it just replicates what it's like to be in a psychoanalytic situation with our own shadow, and also in a personal relationship confrontation like Levinas talks about, but it's on this incredibly massive scale, and it's just almost impossible to encompass. So we're out of